15 years on the job. You think you've seen it all, said the balding detective sitting on my left. You can definitely add unique to that profile of yours, he whispered to me as the DI carried on. Like the first Vic, Abian was last seen drinking at a bar with colleagues near her office in Clerkenwell. Pejman was abducted after leaving the bar, saying she was calling it a night. It's possible the same thing happened to Abian, though we'll know more after House to House have finished up and digital forensics have had time to do their thing. Both victims were likely to have been abducted from the same place. That suggests the perp feels comfortable there. Does he work in the area, or is there some other attraction? Do we have Pejman on CCTV? Said a detective sitting bone straight, wearing a buttoned-up waistcoat complete with a tie and perfectly folded teal pocket square.
Sadly not, Silk, said Isaacson, shrugging his shoulders as if he'd never expected to. We've got footage of her outside the bar, then walking off in the direction of Moorgate Tube Station. We've got her again heading down Old Street, but after that she makes a turn down Vince Street, which is a blind spot, and the cameras lose her. We do have other CCTV footage, but it has to be watched frame by frame. It doesn't help that the feeds aren't stitched together, or that the images are so bloody low res.
There was a bit of eye-rolling round the room. This was a common gripe. The weather was mad last night. The kids got into bed with me and the wife around 2. They were freaking out about the thunder, said another detective, a guy in his late 40s with a gut he could have balanced a pint on. It was shit when Pejman was killed, too. Maybe the Vicks took a cab or accepted a lift from someone.
It's possible, said Isaacson. Witnesses claim to have seen someone matching Pejman's description getting into a vehicle, but before you all go getting excited, none of them could agree on make, colour or model.
More eye-rolling.
Both victims were found in unlit, deserted Mews Streets in Primrose Hill. Both were murdered there, which means we've been able to secure the primary crime scenes, which is something. Too much to hope there's any CCTV, I suppose, said the dad with the gut. Afraid so. The cameras in the area have been destroyed recently by a helpful anti-Big Brother group. A couple of youths have been arrested and charged after posting something on their blog, but as yet they haven't been replaced. Budget constraints. You know the drill.
The sort of thing a resident might know about? I said, tapping my lips with the end of my biro.
Very possibly. There was a piece about it not long ago in the Ham and High, a local rag. I've circulated copies of the first Vic's PM report for you all to take a look at. But the main points to note are these. Massive trauma to the womb region and multiple stab wounds to the breasts and thighs from an 8-inch knife.
Sounds like me trying to carve the turkey last Christmas, said a detective with dark lines of brown plaque between his teeth and a smattering of pimples on his jawline.
Isaacson and I didn't laugh, but the rest of the team guffawed. Chapter 15. The blood rushed to my face. I spoke without thinking. Never a good move.
Think it's funny, do you? I said. That's someone's wife and mother lying in the freezer. Maybe you should go share the joke with them.
There was a second stunned silence before Isaacson spoke.
You took the words out of my mouth, Mackenzie, he said. Now, if the rest of you are ready to behave like grown-ups, we can carry on.
There was a bit of awkward shuffling as the DI wrapped up the sit-rep. I kept my eyes trained on him, but that didn't stop me clocking the daggers Pimple Face was throwing at me. I really was beating my record on the friend-making front today.
Any questions before I hand out jobs?
More of a comment, actually, I said, raising a hand. The attack on the womb is common to both Vicks, which makes it a key aspect of the signature, and the level of overkill demonstrates extreme rage on the part of the offender. Possibly, he's trying to destroy what he can't have. I mentioned earlier he may be impotent. He gets his thrills by stabbing his victims, penetrating them with his blade because he can't use his penis. He possibly feels emasculated by a female figure in his life, most likely a spouse or girlfriend, given the position of the stab wounds. The emasculation could stem from anything. The female could belittle him, have been unfaithful, or perhaps earn more than him. The breasts and thighs are sexual regions. By focusing on those areas, the killer's trying to destroy his victim's femininity. That shows he's threatened by it. What I saw this morning reinforces that. Displaying the body in a humiliating position is a classic part of what we call the anger retaliation signature.
"In English," said Pimples, his jaw jutting forward.
There were a few sniggers. "It means this guy's all about power and control.
And he's a misogynist dick like you."
"The uterus is a powerful symbol of motherhood," I said instead. "This level of anger comes from a deeply rooted hatred of women, or more likely, a woman in particular. The victims are stand-ins for the person who emasculates him, shown by their striking similarity. If he is impotent, it may be that his partner blames him for her inability to get pregnant, and he's lashing out against women who look like her because he feels unable to take his anger out on her directly. Yet.
Yet?
It's a matter of time. His work shows he's unravelling fast. He'll carry on targeting surrogates until he gets up the confidence to go after the true source of his rage, and his cooling down periods will start to shorten.
"Better shut down your Tinder account, eh, Frost?"
whispered a skinny bloke to the female detective. He spoke quietly, but lip-reading was always a handy skill in my old job. I understood him as plainly as if he'd been talking into my ear. There were a few more questions after that, mainly about what the major crimes unit we'd taken over from had dug up so far. The short answer was, not much.
"Any sign of ejaculate at either scene?" said the dad detective with the gut.
Isakson shook his head, a brisk side to side.
"Really?"
I said. A killing of this sort, certainly at the beginning of a series, almost always involves an orgasm on the part of the offender by or in the body.
"Why are you so surprised? It was you who said he was a Flacido Domingo," said Pimples, scouting for a laugh.
It was a lame gag, but I smiled dutifully. "Impotent men can still ejaculate through masturbation," I said. "Though if he took a souvenir, he might have waited till he got home."
"Doesn't look like he did take anything,"
said Isakson.
"At least not from Pejman. She was found wearing a necklace, a palm-shaped amulet called a Hamza, apparently. The husband didn't identify anything as being missing, and no body parts were removed from the scene."
"A serial killer and no eyeballs in the fridge. Just my luck," said the skinny guy.
"I knew I shouldn't have introduced you to Hannibal," said another.
There was more laughing, but I didn't join in. I was busy thinking. In cases like this, when the perp doesn't jerk off at the scene, he takes a trophy from the victim and jacks the beanstalk on his home turf. Yet there's nothing to suggest this perp did either of these things. The question was, why?
"One last thing before we get this show on the road," said Isakson, glancing at his watch. "The CSIs haven't finished up yet, but I did hear something relevant back from the crime scene manager about an hour ago. As you'd expect, his team's found a number of partial footwear marks around the body that don't match the victim's shoe sole tread. But what's interesting is this. They've also found marks further away from the scene, pointing towards it, as if someone was standing there looking in."
My blood jumped. Maybe I wasn't being paranoid after all. Maybe the killer really had been watching me earlier. Chapter 16.
While CSI finishes processing the crime scene, our main focus needs to be on finding witnesses and interviewing the victim's family, friends and colleagues, said Isakson, before going on to allocate tasks and partners and handing out team contact details. Put these in your phones, people. They're no use to anyone left on your desks. Mackenzie, I'd like you and Ruddock here to interview Axel Montand and Dan Harper over at Scutton Montand. They were heading up the team on the mergers and acquisitions transaction both victims were working on when they were killed. Montand's an equity partner, Harper's a salaried one. Big fish, in other words. Have a quick read-up on the firm before you go. Nothing too technical, just to give you the lie of the land.
I glanced over at Pimples. He didn't look any happier for us to be lumped together than I was.
When you've finished there, you can head down to the morgue. And I've arranged for you to meet with Pejman's other half at 3 this afternoon, Tristan Fontaine. You'll find his details waiting in your inboxes. Mackenzie, I believe you have a Scotland Yard email address, but if you have any problems logging in, just let the office manager know and he'll sort you out.
Copy.
And how do you feel about presenting an initial profile at the evening briefing?
I'll do my best. We should get a statement out to the press before that, though. I'm happy to draft one before Ruddock and I head out, if you like.
No need. The press can wait.
It'd be a good idea to get in front of the story. Apart from managing hysteria, it'll look like we're on top of the situation.
I've said it can wait. Now, if everyone knows what they're doing, let's get going. And make sure you all familiarise yourselves with the PM and preliminary police reports before you go rubbing shoulders with the general public.
There was the sound of chairs being scraped back, and the usual end-of-meeting jabber.
Mackenzie, can I have a quick word?
Said Isaacson, as the team filed out. His tone wasn't promising.
What's up, sir?
Falcon says you're ex-Special Forces.
Aye, Special Reconnaissance Regiment. He nodded. His jaw was tight, his eyes narrowed.
We've had trouble in the past, using non-police personnel. The army has a very different way of doing things to us.
Was this his beef about having me on the team? If so, I understood. And if I'd been in his place, I may well have felt the same way. Not long after 7-7, three members of my own unit had been responsible for the fatal shooting of an innocent man. They'd been monitoring him alongside the Met, and wrongly identified him as a suspected suicide bomber. It hadn't done much to improve relations between the two services, and had left many at Scotland Yard wary of enlisting our help. The term clusterfuck wasn't strong enough for what had gone down. I chose my words carefully. I'm here to offer whatever insight I can. I looked Isaacson square in the eye. My role is purely advisory. I'm not here to tread on any toes, and I take my orders from you. The DI unclenched his jaw muscle. His shoulders dropped. I'd placated him. For now. Chapter 17.
I think it'd be different if I had someone to talk to. Back when I first met my husband, I had plenty of friends. I was never exactly prom queen material. GC was always the jock, not me. But in college, I had a good group. They weren't judgy like the kids I knew growing up, and they were fun to hang out with, too. My husband didn't like them, though. He used to say they were acid-head losers, and no good for me, and why did I need them when we had each other? At the time, I thought he was right. He was my world. All I wanted was him. Except now I don't have him either, and the whole thing's my fault. I can't blame it on my father-in-law anymore. This isn't about the snide comments and him trying to poison my husband against me. It's about what I did, and although I know I deserve it, his contempt stabs right through me all the same. He gets this look sometimes, a look of absolute hate that reminds me of that horrid skull painting in the Tate with the worms coming out the eye sockets. I'll be sitting there, minding my own business, reading Vogue or flicking through a cookbook or whatever, and I'll catch him staring at me with that look. It makes me freeze. I mean, I literally can't move, not even swallow. Yet other times he can be so sweet. Like the other day, when he suggested we go away for a while. and then the next minute I'll say something stupid and he'll turn, so I'm always walking on pins, never knowing what I might do wrong next.
Chapter 18. Scott and Montan, Clerkenwell, London, 10:30.
Fancy, said Ruddock with a whistle as we walked into Scott and Montan, the law firm where the victims had worked. The marble entrance hall was dotted with huge displays of birds of paradise and other bright tropical flowers that likely cost more than my weekly grocery bill.
I heard it's known as S&M, he said. Reckon it has anything to do with the hot totty behind those reception desks over there?
Geez, I couldn't wait to spend the day with this clown Dick. We went over to speak to the hot totty, and a short while later, a man with a sprinkling of freckles across his nose and deep-set laughter lines came over to find us. Dan Harper, the salaried partner with day-to-day responsibility for the deal the victims had been working on. He introduced himself and held out a hand. It was warm, the skin soft. Absent-minded, I thought, taking in Harper's mismatched cufflinks and the indentation on his wrist where his watch usually sat.
Terrible business. Can't get my head round it. We're all shaken up.
He led us into a small conference room, all glass walls and doors.
Yasmin was really popular round here, and now Lily's gone too. I found out when I got in this morning. Someone from Scotland Yard called ahead, said to expect you.
There'll be more of us along later to talk to the rest of the team, said Ruddock.
Harper nodded and pressed his lips together, taking it in.
Do you have any idea who's behind it? Who killed them, I mean?
I know I talk fast, but this guy was seriously gabbling. Obviously strung out. Understandable, given the circumstances.
You worked with them both. Can you tell us what they were like? I said as we sat down. He scratched his head.
Nice. Hard working, but good fun, too. I mean, everyone liked them.
A few minutes into the questioning, his mobile vibrated on the table. A woman's name lit up on the screen. Sarah. No surname, so not a work call then. Harper checked his wrist where his watch should have been.
Sorry, do you mind? Here's my wife, he said, ducking out of the room.
Ruddock and I exchanged looks.
Bit odd, he said. Must be important for him to take a call during a police interview.
We watched Harper talking through the glass walls. He doesn't look happy.
Well, it is his missus he's talking to.
Twat.
Sorry about that, said Harper, coming back in.
His hand shook as he placed the phone down on the table. Everything all right? I said.
Absolutely fine. Sorry, she's just not well.
I made sympathetic noises, then carried on with the questions. You were at the bar with Yasmin the night she was killed. He flushed.
Yes, but I wasn't the only one. A lot of us were out that night. We'd just closed a big deal. We were celebrating.
And you spoke to her before she left? All this was in the initial police reports, but I wanted to hear it from him.
Well, yes. I waited outside with her for a bit. She wanted to get a cab. But after a while, she gave up and said she'd get the tube before the train stopped running.
He looked uncomfortable, but then that was to be expected. After all, he was the last person to see Yasmin Pejman alive. And as a lawyer, he must have known that had put him firmly on the suspect list.
Chapter 19.
You told the detectives you spoke to last week that you'd gone back into the bar after Yasmin left and stayed there till closing, said Ruddock, making a show of looking in his notebook, trying not to come on too heavy.
It was a big night. Like I said, we were celebrating.
Doesn't your wife mind you staying out so late? I glanced at his wedding ring, a thick gold band.
She doesn't like it much, actually, but it comes with the territory, you know? We're expected to work hard and play hard in this job.
He maintained eye contact, but not like he was trying too hard. His voice was calm, albeit wary, but then again we were pressing him on his alibi. Guilty or innocent, no one likes that.
What time did you get home the night Yasmin was killed?
Around 1:45.
And last night? He looked down at his hands, chewing his lip.
We were all in the same bar as last time. Lily and I went outside to have a smoke, around 11, maybe? Then we came back in together. They were playing that Avril Lavigne song, When You're Gone.
He was adding as many details as he could to back up his alibi. And he'd have known they were details we could verify.
When did you make tracks?
Said Ruddock, looking up from his notebook where he'd been scribbling. He shrugged.
Just before closing, I guess. I shared a cab back with a colleague, Charles Bishop.
Ruddock jotted the name down in his notebook to follow up later.
Before you ask, I got dropped off first, and my wife woke up when I came in.
We'd have to check his story out, but the alibi certainly sounded strong. The way it was looking, Dan Harper wasn't our guy. Though if the killer knew both victims, there was a high probability it was someone who worked at the firm.
That'll be all for now, said Ruddock.
I handed Harper my card. In case you think of anything else. And now would you mind letting Mr. Montong know we're ready to talk to him?
Chapter 20. Scutton Montong, Clerkenwell, London, 11:25.
Axel Montong, I'm one of the partners here,
said a tiny man with simian features, glacier blue eyes and thick blonde hair worn in a quiff. He'd kept us waiting for 15 minutes without so much as an apology.
We shook hands. He crushed my bones in an iron grip. A man who likes to dominate. I looked him over. He was very young for an equity partner. He must have been around my age, so early 30s. And he was dressed head to toe in labels. Prada suit, Rolex watch, and a Hermes tie. The shirt was probably designer too, for all I knew. Plenty of money then, and a need to show off. Someone for whom status is all important.
Montong as in Scutton Montong, I said.
My father's one of the founding partners, he said with a pleased with himself smile.
The guy may have earned his position, but more likely, given his age, it was a case of nepotism over excellence. And the smile said it didn't bother him one bit.
Ruddock took the lead on questioning.
He'd just established that Montong had been in the bar with both victims the night they'd died and had left early when the lawyer interrupted him.
I've got nothing to hide. Feel free to corroborate what time I got home with my wife, though officers have already spoken to her about the night Yasmin was killed. In return, I wonder if you'd do me a favour.
His voice dripped with honey.
I'd be grateful if you'd keep the firm's name out of the papers. This sort of thing really isn't good for business.
By this sort of thing, you mean the brutal murder of two women you worked with? I said, wondering how much trouble I'd get into for giving him a nosebleed.
I knew you'd understand.
He smiled a charming smile, full TV white teeth and expensive dentistry. Snake in a Suit, I thought. It was the title of a book I'd read recently about how common psychopathic behaviour is amongst business leaders. The hallmarks of a psychopathic personality, charisma, egocentricity, and lack of empathy, are supposedly the same qualities that help people excel in a commercial environment. We're trying to understand who might have had a reason to hurt Yasmin and Lily, I said, eyeballing him. Can you tell us how well you knew them?
I can tell you anything you like. I've got nothing to hide.
The second time he'd said it.
Chapter 21.
What in the mother of dog shit is wrong with that Montong character? I shook my head. He didn't give a crap about Pejman and Abian. All he's interested in is his precious firm's reputation. Maybe it's the military girl in me, but the way I saw it, Axel Montong had a duty of care to his team. His first responsibility should have been to his people. But instead, his primary concern was the bottom line.
However, Montan wasn't the only one who'd got my hackles up. I know the guys at the yard joke around to deflect the horror of the crimes they have to deal with. The more depraved the act, the worse the gags. I get it. It's a coping strategy. I'm no stranger to gallows humour. But I still couldn't shrug off the crass remarks from the briefing earlier. It wasn't like me. I'm not exactly Miss Prim and Proper. The banter would usually have slid right off my back. But I couldn't help it. These attacks were getting to me whether I wanted to admit it or not. It was partly how much I looked like the victims, and obviously the Iranian surnames beefed up the connection, but it went deeper than that. The signature had triggered a primal response, a muscle memory I'd been suppressing for the last 2 years. My womb hadn't been ripped out back then, but it might as well have been. And on top of all that, I couldn't help feeling I was the only one who cared about what had happened to the women at a human level. For the others, it was a job, just another set of bodies on the slab, as in many ways it should have been. For me, it felt personal. We walked over to Chiswell Street, where I'd parked. A momentary shaft of sunlight hit my baby's paintwork, making it gleam like a heavenly object.
"Beats a pool car," Ruddock said as I unlocked the doors. "Any chance I could get behind the wheel?"
"None."
"I was due to go on annual leave next week," he said later as we turned onto Old Street. "My heart sank when the DCI told me I was wanted on the team. I mean, what could I say? I'm bloody cursed, I am."
There's so much I wanted to answer to that, but an SMS from Jack stopped me.
"Have you heard? The Primrose Hill Killer's struck again. The rags are calling him the Hillside Slasher. It's all over their websites. Bet you get called in on this."
The Hillside Slasher. Typical sensationalist bull, I thought. Trust the tabloids to come up with that one. It didn't do much to help our cause either. Nicknames give offenders a celebrity status which 9 times out of 10 they revel in. It's why so many of them write to the papers with suggestions. The Zodiac Killer, the Son of Sam, the BTK Strangler, they all did it. I wouldn't be dignifying this boorbag by calling him anything other than what he is. A cold-hearted murderer. "Here, check this out," I said to Ruddock, passing him my phone so he could read Jack's message.
"That's not good."
Isaacson should have let me draft a statement. Social media changes everything. You can't sit on this sort of thing. It's the way panic spreads. Yasmin Pejman's homicide had already attracted massive public interest. Not just because of the shocking brutality, or because she was young and pretty, the winning formula, as far as most reporters are concerned, but because of her son, a preschooler with a head of blonde curls and dimples you could sink your thumb into. The Sun had printed a photo of him staring out of his bedroom window, with tears running down his face. The headline read, "I want my mummy." The image stuck. Within hours, the crime was the biggest news story in Britain. The second attack would make it even bigger. I called the DI to tell him we were on our way back in and that I'd be putting together a response for the press office to release immediately. He was in charge of running the investigation, but media strategy was my bag. Serial killers follow the news. This one would be no exception, which meant we needed to get our message right.
Chapter 22. St. Pancras Public Mortuary, London, 1332.
"Want a crisp?"
said Ruddock, proffering a packet of quavers as we walked up Camley Street and over the railway bridge to the St. Pancras Public Mortuary after our detour to the yard.
"I'm good, thanks."
He shrugged and shoved a handful into his mouth, crunching loudly. What the guy could really do with was a double dose of vitamin C and a trip to the hygienist. There was a rusty gate on the left. I pushed it open and skipped up the stone steps to the morgue's swanky modern entrance.
The pathologist Isakson had called Mouse at the crime scene this morning came down to meet us. He was scowling and out of breath, his liver-spotted scalp showing through his comb-over.
"Come along then, this way,"
he said, in a not-too-chuffed-to-see-us voice.
"Donald said you'd be stopping by."
I bit my tongue. It probably wasn't the best idea to ask if he called the DI Duck. He led us into a spotless, brightly lit room lined with banks of drawers, stainless steel trolleys, sinks and workstations. Then, checking his clipboard, he pulled open a freezer drawer containing Yasmin Pejman's corpse before going to fetch his notes from the other side of the room. Pejman's skin was grey from being kept below 2°C. There was a hospital-style bracelet round her wrist and a white sheet draped over her torso. It may have looked like a movie prop, but the body on the cold tray in front of me had been a person. A mother, a daughter, a wife. I've seen plenty of corpses, but the sadness of murder, the premature end to a life, always affects me. Now, more than ever, given what happened to Duncan and what the shock of his death precipitated. Without thinking, I touched my stomach. I glanced over at Ruddock. He was looking a little green around the gills. "Don't like being around bone cutters, eh?"
"Actually, I was just thinking how much she reminds me of a bird I used to date. She was cold and lifeless, too."
"And there I was, thinking you were still a virgin."
I really didn't like this guy.
The pathologist came over, adjusting his glasses.
"What can you tell us about the deceased?" said Ruddock, back in professional mode.
We'd both read the PM report, but Mouse would be able to zoom in on the key points better than we could. In a day or so, once her post-mortem had been finalised, we'd be able to compare the results to Abian's.
"Stomach content analysis revealed she had eaten Thai food approximately 3 hours before her death. However, there were no traces of any toxins that would suggest a state of internal poisoning."
So Pejman had a meal before going to the bar, but she hadn't been drugged by the offender prior to the attack. That meant a ruse was still looking likely.
"Back levels were 0.117%.
Definitely over the driving limit. Inebriated. Defences down. That made her a high-risk victim. One who'd be easier to trick and overpower."
"Any idea exactly how much she'd been drinking?"
Ruddock said.
"It's hard to say. These tests aren't 100% reliable. Post-mortem fermentation can push up back levels. And, of course, she wasn't found until at least 8 hours after the attack. I can give you a clearer picture, re the stab wounds, though. I counted 29 in total of varying depths of penetration, all made by the same blade. The measurements are documented in my report."
It takes a lot of effort to stab someone that many times. Anger, too. This crime wasn't just about emasculation. It was also about a trauma. Something that had happened recently. Possibly that was even the trigger.
"You must understand, any attempt to extrapolate the dimensions of the knife from these wounds is rife with inaccuracies. Owing to the skin's elasticity, which causes it to shrink by up to 2 millimetres on withdrawal of the blade,"
Mouse said, looking from me to Ruddock. Typical pathologist, trying to blind us with the science.
"However, luckily for us, she was stabbed in the liver."
I raised an eyebrow. I didn't see how being stabbed in a major organ was lucky for anyone.
"Liver stab wounds retain the characteristics of the blade that makes them."
He articulated each word slowly, breaking it down Barney style.
"My examination showed the knife used on the deceased had an 8-inch blade. At a guess, I'd say it was probably a carving knife."
Narrows it down, I thought. A carving knife is easy to get hold of, easy to dispose of, hard to trace.
"The force required to puncture skin with a sharp knife is fairly low, and it swiftly drops off as the blade perforates fat and muscle. However, the force used in this attack was very low indeed,
much lower than I'd expect to see in a crime like this. So, despite the blitz style of the attack, only a minimal pressure had been used to stab the victim. Surprising.
Does that imply poor upper body strength on the part of the offender? I said.
Very possibly, yes. Like the body I examined this morning, there were no defence wounds on Ms. Pejman, and the first incision was made here, at the back of the neck.
So, she'd been taken by surprise, stabbed from behind, and incapacitated before she had a chance to fight back. The victim was a small woman who'd been drinking, yet her killer didn't feel confident about overpowering her physically. Another thing to suggest he's physically weak, I said, turning to Ruddock.
Not just weak, said the pathologist. The angle at which the blade entered the skin gives us a clue as to his height. It's not 100% accurate, mind, but...
He paused and massaged his suprasternal notch, the dip between the neck and the collarbone. We won't quote you, I said.
Well, okay. Just bear in mind this is more a hunch than anything. I can't be completely sure, but judging by the knife angle and the position of the wounds on the deceased's body, I don't think the offender's much taller than the victim.
Yasmin Pejman was only 5'4". The offender must be tiny.
Just like Axel Monton, said Ruddock.
There's another thing, the pathologist said, pushing his glasses up his nose.
As I said, the deceased was stabbed 29 times, but there were no hesitation marks on the body. Not a single one.
The implication was clear. Our perp had killed before. Chapter 23. Home of Yasmin Pejman, 1538.
Miss Mackenzie, Alwyn James, mail on Sunday. Any comments about the hillside slasher turning serial?
Tanya Spearer, The Mirror. Does Scotland Yard have any leads yet?
Peter Thornton, Daily Express. Is Tristan Fontaine a person of interest in your investigation?
The pack on the front lawn started baying the second I ran Yasmin Pejman's doorbell and announced who I was to her husband, Tristan, over the entry phone. A group of kids fresh out of school had stopped for selfies. Me outside a dead woman's house, hashtag aren't I so cool.
Ghouls.
Less than a fortnight ago, they were likely dressed up as monsters hollering trick or treat. Now a real fiend was in their midst, only he wouldn't be in fancy dress. He'd blend right in. The front door opened and the cameras started clicking.
Mr. Fontaine, how are you holding up?
Tristan, are you satisfied the police are doing everything they can to find your wife's killer?
Mr. Fontaine, how's your son doing?
Vultures,
muttered Pejman's husband, hovering in the doorway, a critter staring down a rifle.
They've been here ever since the body was found.
His voice was slurred. That'll be the Valium, I thought. Bloody GPs. Always so quick to hand out the smarties. They tried to stuff them down my throat after Duncan died, too. The press pack was still clamouring, the ultimate double-edged sword. Journalists can be a pain in the jacksie, but nothing beats the media in terms of getting witnesses to come forward. I'm Zeba McKenzie, a profiler with Scotland Yard, and this is DC Ruddock. Sorry we're a little late. May we come in? I said in a gentle voice to Tristan Fontaine, deliberately submissive and non-threatening. It occurred to me that Yasmin's killer may have gone for a similar approach, right before he stabbed her from behind with his 8-inch blade.
Like I told your boss, I've already talked to the police. I don't know what else I can tell you.
I'm sorry to make you go through everything again, but it's really important we hear about Yasmin from you. Understanding your wife will help us better understand who killed her.
How's that?
He looked puzzled. Knowing what makes an offender select a particular target can reveal a lot about them. It gives an insight into how they think. I didn't add that perps tend to hold back from narrowing in on a victim until the right one comes along, one that fits their fantasies perfectly. And if we can work out what those are, we can predict what they're going to do next.
You'd better come through, Fontaine said, opening the door wider.
His eyelids were puffy from crying. His beard was growing out, and judging by the stains and smell, he'd been wearing the same T-shirt for days.
I've been in that place. I've stood where he was standing.
It gets better, I promise, I said, touching his forearm.
The pain never goes away, but you learn to live with it.
I'm not usually one to bare my soul to strangers, but the empathy was necessary to build rapport. Profiler 101. You can't establish a baseline of behavior without it. Fontaine looked at me properly for the first time.
My husband was murdered too, I said, explaining. 2 years ago now. I'm sorry.
He didn't ask what had happened to Duncan. I liked him for that.
I still can't believe it, you know, he said. This is the sort of thing that happens to other people. You read about it in the news, you see it on the telly, but you don't think it's ever going to happen to you.
Aye, I know.
I didn't realize you were Scottish.
I'm not, my husband was, though. The I thing comes from him.
Which is why you'll never drop it,
he said with a sad smile. Only someone truly bereaved could have said something so spot on. We followed him into the living room. There were bookshelves running from floor to ceiling. True crime books. Catching killers. Unsolved murders. Evil on our streets. A row of leather-bound Shakespeares. Some Geoffrey Archer hardbacks and plenty of paperbacks. Crime, mostly. Anne Cleves, Alexander McCall Smith, and what must have been a complete set of Agatha Christie, arranged alphabetically. Jack would approve. He's obsessed with the woman. Murder mysteries and flying magazines are about all he reads. Who's the bookworm? I said to Tristan Fontaine.
That'd be me.
He stooped to pick up a yellow Tonka truck with a missing wheel and a handful of Lego bricks.
Sorry about the mess. My son's toys get everywhere. Ah, so that's where Dada got to, he said,
pulling a bedraggled beanie dog out from under the sofa by its floppy leg. One of its eyes was missing, and it had a bald patch on its left ear.
He's Toby's favourite toy. Carries him everywhere. I got him in Hamleys. He named him Dada after me.
Ruddock and I must have looked blank because he quickly added,
That's what he calls me.
These must be his too. Ruddock nodded at a wall of artwork, joining me in the rapport thing. There was a child's painting of a house with a cloud of smoke coming out of the chimney. A pink person with a big smiley face. And a crayon drawing of three stick people holding hands. My family, written in uneven letters along the top. Pictures from a happy childhood. They'd be black and whites from here on in.
My boy's quite the artist, said Tristan with a sad smile.
He's cute, I said, picking up a photo frame from the end unit. It was a picture of a curly-haired boy with sticky-out ears, a face covered in chocolate sauce, and a massive grin. Yasmin and Tristan were standing either side of him. She was posing with one hand on her hip and shielding her eyes from the sun with the other. Tristan was slightly in front of her, body blocking her with his torso, both his hands on the boy's shoulders. It was possessive, just like what came next.
He looks just like me. Everyone says so, Tristan Fontaine said.
He took the frame out of my hand and put it back on the shelf. Staking a claim, I thought. Interesting. Shall we get started? I said. Chapter 24. Ruddock and I sat on the sofa with Tristan Fontaine in an armchair across from us, a photo of Yasmin on the end table next to him. She was heavily made up, throwing a supermodel pout at the camera, a woman who liked attention then. Pejman was a pretty girl, way out of Fontaine's league, with his sausage fingers, piggy eyes, and hair so white he could have been albino, It was hard to imagine them together. Ruddock and I had gone through our interview strategy on the way over. He was going to leave the talking to me, maybe throw Fontaine the odd bone if it seemed like he was getting wound up. This might have looked like an informal chat, a chance for us to get to know the victim, as I'd said when we came in. But the truth is, the husband's always a suspect. In more than half of all personal cause homicides, the partner did it. This was a serial murder investigation, but we needed to put Tristan Fontaine under a microscope all the same. I started up with the questions. First, family dynamics. Did Yasmin get on well with her parents?
Well, they live in Leeds, so we don't see a lot of them. I always said 3 hours in the back of the car's a bit much for my son, but Yas spoke to them on the phone a few times a week.
So unlikely to be any abuse or neglect issues in her past to inform her current behaviour. How about brothers or sisters?
She has an elder sister. They were close. She's good to my boy.
And how long have you and Yasmin been living in London?
We came to uni here and ended up staying. I was worried the city wasn't the best place to bring up my son. All the pollution, you know? But the job opportunities are so much better here, so...
He trailed off. I tucked a strand of hair behind my ear and looked down at my notes. Not only was he bringing his kid, my son, into every answer, but at this point in the conversation it was strange he wasn't referring to him by name. It's like he only existed in context of his relationship to Fontaine. Did Yasmin have any physical disabilities?
No.
Not a high-risk victim, then. And how did you and Yasmin meet?
In the student union. We didn't mix in the same crowd, though. Her friends weren't really my type. A bit druggy, if you must know. But she and I hit it off straight away. I never used to believe in all that Thunderbolt stuff, but the moment I saw her, I just knew we were meant to be together.
He rubbed the back of his neck. A pacifying gesture, the body's instinctive way of comforting itself. There was more to their story than he was letting on, and it sounded way too much like a movie cliché to be true. And she felt the same way? I said with a smile, not wanting to come across like I was challenging him.
Yes.
His eyes dropped to his lap. So that's a no, then. And how would you describe your relationship with Yasmin? The key question, hidden in a haystack of more superficial ones.
Fine, he said, tugging his earlobe. Good.
Liar, I thought. Everything about his body language was screaming that things were the very opposite of fine. Maybe that's why she kept her maiden name. Was he as possessive with Yasmin as he is over his kid? And if so, how did she react to that? Toe the line or push back? Did your wife have any hobbies?
She wasn't into the gym. Said she didn't have the build for weights and all that, but she loved running.
So would have tried to flee if she'd felt threatened. That supported the idea of a ruse and a surprise assault.
We used to go round the track in Regent's Park together on Sunday mornings before my son was born. I was in better shape back then.
Fontaine gave a self-deprecating smile.
If God wanted us to exercise, he wouldn't have let us invent the wheel, said Ruddock, all matey-matey.
Fontaine smiled again. This time it was warmer. I wouldn't be inviting pimples to birthday drinks, but he knew what he was doing. I had to give him that. I moved on to the next stage of the victimology personality assessment questionnaire. You told the police she was streetwise?
Yeah, definitely. She wasn't naive. She didn't take risks.
The weather was terrible the night she died. Might she have accepted a lift from a stranger?
No way.
He was adamant. If Yasmin Pejman got into a car, it was because she knew her attacker. Are you aware of anyone who might have had a reason to hurt her? Any threats she might have received? Any sort of harassment? Fontaine shook his head.
Are you sure? Said Ruddock in a gentle voice. It could be relevant.
I'd have known if someone was giving her a hard time. We didn't keep stuff from each other.
Bullshit, I thought, noting everything his reactions were telling me. Those two definitely had secrets. The question is, what were they?
Chapter 25. I got in the tub today for the first time since that blackout. Hours later, I'm still shaking. I can't stop binging and purging. My brain's all plowed up. I was so desperate to remember what had happened. Now all I want to do is forget. I was sitting with my knees bent to my chin, shushing up the foam with my hand, the heat from the water making me lightheaded, when it happened. An honest-to-goodness flashback. Like after what happened with GC. Except 100 times worse. It's late. Maybe 2 or 3 in the morning, judging by the color of the darkness outside. My heart starts thumping. How did I get here? What's going on? My husband is in the bathroom with me. He's yanking my clothes off, shouting at me. Keep still, damn it, he says, his voice all hard and rasping. He's hurting me. He has my arms in a vice grip. I can't get away. My hands are useless against him. He's too strong for me. I've never seen him this fired up. It's like there's a heat coming off him. He smells of beer and sweat. A dirty smell. He's been with her, I think. But how can I accuse him of anything, after what I did? I'm crying. Tears and snot run into my mouth. I taste salt. I try to get away, but the door's locked and my fingers slip on the bolt. He grabs me, swearing under his breath, and we struggle, but I'm no match for him. And the next thing, he's got me into the tub. The faucet's running, but the water's cold. He hasn't turned the hot on. I'm shivering, begging. Why are you doing this? Please stop. But he doesn't listen. Instead, he forces me under, head, hair, everything. Keep still while I wash away the bad, he says, his voice distorting through the water. I wonder how long I can hold my breath for. My lungs are starting to burn. I've wanted to die for so long. But now it's happening. My body's fighting back. My eyes shoot open. I'm struggling. Everything's blurry. But I can see my husband's face, and it terrifies me. Because he's smiling. He's enjoying this.
Chapter 26. Scotland Yard, 1715. I'll see you up there, I said to Ruddock, as we waited for the copper on the gate to check our passes back at HQ. The way I saw it, unless someone else on the team had come up with anything blinding today, behavioural analysis was going to be key to finding this perp. Pejman wasn't his first kill. I'd seen firsthand the extent of his bloodlust, and the fact he hadn't been caught yet would make him feel invincible. Time wasn't on our side. But this wasn't the only game of beat the clock I had going on. Working at the yard put me in the perfect position to chase up leads on Duncan's flash drive, though there was no way of knowing how long I'd be on site. It looked like Gavin Handler, 9 months undercover, where's the evidence, was a DC in vice. I still had to finalise the preliminary profile before presenting it to the team, but if I was quick, there was just enough time to nip upstairs to see Handler first. This is bullcrap, I thought. I should be making Duncan's homicide my priority, not grabbing 5 minutes here or there when I get the chance. And yet, at the same time, the Primrose Hill case was shouting for my full attention, not least because the killer may well be lining up his next victim. I sighed. Wherever I aimed my bang stick, my shot would be off. Spending too much time on the flash drive would mean neglecting an active investigation. Yet this was the first piece of real evidence in years. How could I ignore that? Screwed if I do, screwed if I don't, I thought, for the second time that day.
The guard handed back our IDs and stood aside to let us through the gate. The courtyard was empty apart from two men loitering on the steps to the building, deep in conversation. They struck me as an unlikely couple. One was wearing an impeccable navy suit, bespoke by the looks of it, high-end tailoring, slicked back hair, someone who took care of his appearance. The other was a slob, untucked wrinkled shirt, ketchup on the cuff, eyebrows joining in the middle like two caterpillars shagging. As I looked them over, my jaw dropped, every synapse firing. I couldn't hear what they were saying, we were too far away for that, but it made no bones with me. I'd seen the shape of the word on their lips. Sunlight. I stopped in my tracks. We were closing the gap. I'd got a glimpse of the name on Smarty's visitor badge, but another second and I'd lose the chance to find out what they were saying.
What's wrong with you?
Ruddock turned to me, zitty face puzzled. Nothing, I said through clenched teeth. Trust bloody pimples to pop the bubble. I could have decked him. The two men had stopped talking and were now looking our way.
Evening, Watkiss,
said Ruddock, nodding at the slob, his voice deferential for a change. They made brief small talk, but I wasn't paying attention. I was too focused on what the spotty one had just said. Watkiss. Another name from Duncan's file. Chapter 27. Briefing Room, Scotland Yard, 1800.
So, what do you think, Mackenzie?
Said Isaacson, dropping an Alka-Seltzer into a glass of water and loosening his tie.
Do you agree with Ruddock that we should be looking into Axel Montan?
I'm not sure, I said, glancing round the briefing room, which the dad detective with the Santa Claus gut, Big Daddy I was calling him, had stunk out with takeaway fries. He was in the bar with both victims. He slipped away before they left, and we've just heard from Frost that he drives to work. If we can crack the wife's alibi, he's got opportunity.
Plus he's a dwarf, said Ruddock. Can't be more than 5'4", and that's with lifts in his shoes.
5'4" is hardly a dwarf, I said, scowling. I'm touchy about my height.
Okay, not a dwarf, said Ruddock. But Mouse said the perp was short. All I'm saying is Axel Montan fits that bill.
True, but his personality doesn't fit the profile, I said. Montan may be many things, but he's not an emasculated male.
Maybe he just hides it well.
I didn't buy it. But Ruddock had got one thing right. Axel Montan was definitely keen to hide something, and it wasn't his concern with billable hours.
Is the profile always right? Said Big D. I don't mean to diss what you do, Zeba, but if the evidence is pointing in a different direction... I think that's your cue, Mackenzie, said Isaacson, downing his cloudy drink and pulling a face. Now we've finished running through everyone's feedback. Are you ready to go through a more detailed profile?
Sure. I pushed my chair back and moved to the front of the room. The killer's unique signature shows we're looking for an offender with a difficult childhood, one characterized by maternal neglect and possibly psychological abuse. If you were to delve into his background, you'd find a history of fire-starting, bedwetting, and cruelty to animals, or at least two out of those three. Given the age of both victims, I'd expect him to be in his late 20s to early 30s, and he lives in or near Primrose Hill. He uses his vehicle to abduct his targets. He lures them in with a ruse, which explains the absence of defence wounds and ligature marks on the victims. It also suggests the killer has above-average intelligence and reasonable social skills. He targets petite women because bigger victims would be too challenging for him. Yasmin Pejman was a runner, so physically fit, but she was initially attacked from behind. These things tell us the offender is weak, therefore possibly slightly built. And, as Ruddock's already said, he's short too, possibly around 5'4". The number of stab wounds on the first victim's body shows the guy's dealing with some serious anger issues. And there are no hesitation marks,